From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Havana, Cuba, when an American arrived for a chance to see the country and to experience what the thaw in relations actually feels like up close. And yes, we're talking about President Barack Obama and his visit to Cuba this week as part of the normalization of relations between the two nations, but we're also talking about Todd Moss, a Rochester native, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, and now the Chief Operating Officer of the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Moss went to Havana in advance of the president's trip, and he wrote a piece for USA Today titled Cuba's Charming Tragic Time Warp. I asked him to join us on Connections to talk about what he experienced in Cuba. But there are other connections this hour. You see, Todd is also a fiction thriller writer. His first two books were commercial successes, titled The Golden Hour and Minute Zero. The Golden Hour was set in Mali, in Western Africa. Well, later this hour, I'll welcome the real-life Malian ambassador to the United States, Tiana Koulibaly, who is visiting Rochester as part of our Sister Cities program. Just yesterday, gunmen stormed a hotel in Mali's capital of Bamako. Last year, Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists killed dozens in a bombing in Mali. This is a nation that is no stranger to terrorist attack, and it's an ally of the United States. So the ambassador from Mali joins me in our second half hour. But first, let me welcome back Todd Moss to Connections.
Great to be back with you, Evan.
Well, I know just this morning you were supposed to be doing some television segments on Cuba, and we're going to talk about your article that you wrote on Cuba and your experience traveling there in just a moment. But the reason you've been bumped in some places is because so much of the attention is on Brussels, Belgium. And in general, I just want to start there with some of your thoughts on what we're seeing out of Brussels.
Well, it's very sad. You know, I think this is the world we live in, that soft targets like airports and hotels are going to be increasingly dangerous places. It wasn't just Brussels today, but even this week, there was another major hotel attacked in Mali in West Africa by Al-Qaeda-type elements. And I think the challenge for us as a country is not to try to retreat into a bunker, but to try to make sure that we stay engaged with the world despite these increased dangers.
In this case, you know, there's such a rush among public leaders on what we should do and what we should do quickly. And I find that interesting as kind of a juxtaposition with what you've written about in your books and your fiction work, and also with what your own experience in the State Department has been, which is that it is important in certain circumstances to act decisively, quickly, and yet there are also times where overreacting with policy or militarily or whatever the case may not be prudent. How do you view these kind of scenarios like we're seeing in Brussels?
Yeah, that's right, Evan. I think we talked about this last time I was on your show. You know, the Golden Hour and my first novel and my experience at State was that we often missed our opportunity if we didn't act quickly. And that was in the case where we knew what was going on and it was very clear what we wanted to do and how we could achieve our goal. I think that's probably not the case where we've got terror attacks in capitals of our allies, like this morning in Brussels or in Bamako, Mali, earlier this week. And I think actually the opposite is true, where we actually want to be very, very careful that we're not reacting emotionally in a way that's actually going to make things worse and is going to make our country and our people less safe in the long run.
Okay, well, you know, unfortunately, I wish I had more details that we could go over with Brussels, but we're still learning a lot there. So for now, what I want to do is turn our attention to what you have been writing about this week. And that's so much of what the American press covered with the president's trip to Cuba and the warming of relations, the thaw there. You had a chance to go to Havana before President Obama was there, and you wrote for USA Today about it. And so let's just start in general. Why did you take the trip?
So, you know, Cuba is a country that seems on the verge of a major transition. It's somewhere I've wanted to write about, and my third novel, Ghosts of Havana, obviously is set in Cuba, with looking at U.S. role in trying to shape a political transition in that country, and all of the subterfuge and background politics that can make that very complicated. And so I was planning a series of trips this summer and this fall to Cuba as part of that. And I decided I needed to go before President Obama landed because it would be changing quite quickly, even in the matter of a space of a few weeks. So I wanted to see firsthand what it was looking like before Obama landed. So that's why I went.
And, you know, you say that it seems to be on the verge of a major transition, and yet when I read your piece on this trip in USA Today, you talk about really crumbling infrastructure and in many cases kind of a sad scene. So help me understand that those things side by side, that this country could be on the verge of a major transition and yet so much is still crumbling.
Well, Cuba is really a very, very puzzling country for a lot of Americans, including me. You know, it's absolutely stunning. The people are incredibly lively, very warm and gracious, embracing Americans despite our difficult history. At the same time, you know, the country really, it's literally falling apart in front of your eyes. I was walking through neighborhoods that that had mansions lined up, and these mansions looked like something you might find in the middle of a jungle of a lost city. The roofs had crumbled in, the walls were collapsing, there were long wires that looked kind of like jungle vines, which were, of course, down power lines. And it was really quite sad because it looked like a place that was once quite a glorious place that has been allowed to really, really decay. So I think that kind of shows the country's potential, but also the sad history of Cuba.
Well, you do say, you open the piece by saying you did expect a lot of different hassles. You've traveled to dozens of countries around the world, and many of the countries you have traveled to are not exactly the wealthiest nation. So you expected hassles, and you didn't find those hassles. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I thought I would get hassles from the U.S. government, from the Cuban government, probably from the airlines, because there's still no commercial flights. You still have to fly a charter. And I just expected it was going to be a series of headaches, and I really didn't find any of that. I bought my flight online. In the same process, I declared my purpose of going to Cuba. You still can't go for tourism, but there are now 12 approved reasons you're allowed to go, and you self-declare those reasons. And I actually bought my Cuban visa at the Miami airport using my credit card. It was $85, and it couldn't have been easier. It was just like checking into the airport twice. So I thought that was really really very simple. And the fact that it's only 40 minutes from Miami to Havana, it's barely like trying to fly from Washington to New York, very, very quick and quite easy.
I'm talking to Todd Moss, who is a Rochester native and the chief operating officer of the Center for Global Development. His new novel is Ghosts of Havana, forthcoming later this year, and we'll talk about that coming up here. But he recently traveled to Havana, and another issue that you thought might come up would be housing, hotels, the quality. And interesting, you write that Cuba has some hotels, but luckily the government recently allowed small bed and breakfast to open and for people to rent rooms in their homes. How did that go for you?
Well, again, that went really, really easily. You know, the government still has to be... So there are a few big hotels. They're all owned by either the government or some European companies in joint ventures with the government. But a couple of years ago, the government allowed regular Cubans to open up their homes to house foreigners. And that is much nicer. It's a much nicer way to see a country, is to stay with regular people rather than in a big sterile hotel. And I actually booked it online through something called homestay.com, and it worked quite well. It was almost like you would book a B&B online here, right here at home in the U.S.
Okay. And I also was struck by the story you tell of... Let's see if I have. Was it the taxi driver who was chanting, chanting, Obama, amigo, Cuba está contigo.
That's right.
Which just translates to Obama, friend, Cuba is with you. So you set us up with this story, and I'm thinking, well, the whole nation has got to be thrilled that Obama's there. But later in the piece, you meet people who say, big deal. Tell us about that.
That's right. I mean, the first taxi driver, who's really the first person I met off the plane, couldn't have been happier to have an American in his car, super friendly. But I really, while people were very friendly, I asked a lot of folks about President Obama's visit, and it was only about two weeks away. And really, I mostly was met with shrugs. People are happy he's coming. They're happy that we seem to be on a path to making friends again with Cuba. But I think expectations are quite low among Cubans. They've just had the Pope. They just had the French president. And they haven't really seen their lives change much from those visits. So I don't think they expect great things from President Obama. Maybe some more tourists, but not a major change very, very quickly. That, I think, really gets to the policy dilemma for the United States and for President Obama in particular, which is that I think that engaging with Cuba makes a lot of sense. As the president's argued, more than half a century of isolation has not helped us encourage Cuba back to a democratic path. At the same time, President Obama has less than a year to go. He is in a very big hurry to lock down some agreement. And the Castros, both Raul and Fidel, actually want to go as slow as possible. So there's a real mismatch in terms of timelines and expectations.
Had you had the president's ear, if you were working in state now, if this was part of your expertise and specialty, would you have advised this trip to be taken at all, Todd?
You know, I wish I was in the room. I wish I knew what the actual agreements were. You know, a presidential visit, especially at a time when there's a country that we're reengaging with we didn't even have diplomatic relations until a few months ago. That is really supposed to be the cherry on top. And I don't know if we maybe gave that away too prematurely. Again, I think the president doesn't have many months left. I don't think he wanted to travel there too close to the election. I sort of expected he would go between November and next January. So I was a little surprised he went this early. But I think, it's not a very satisfying answer, but time will tell whether this was a smart move that helps to accelerate reforms in Cuba, and helps to increase long-term U.S. influence in Cuba, or if this is going to be viewed in a year or two's time as something that was premature, that we didn't negotiate hard enough, and that Cuba is not really on a path toward greater freedom and democracy.
Well, worth reminding our listeners, and you do it in your USA Today piece as well, that this is still a totalitarian state. And what are the signs of that? What did you see when you were there that reminded you of that?
Well, first, it's a country that's still very, very isolated from the United States. So your cell phone, your ATM, your credit cards, none of those will work there. And you actually don't see Western brands at all. I know in some ways it's refreshing not to see Coca-Cola, but, virtually every country in the world, in fact, I think every country but Cuba and North Korea has Coca-Cola. So it's kind of jarring and a little strange to see none of that. But what's especially stark about Cuba is the deterioration of these buildings just everywhere. So there's an old mantra that economists say, which is no one ever washes a rental car. And I thought of that often, which is that no one maintains a house that the government owns. And really, Cuba is a country that's done some things really well. You know, they have a pretty good health and education system. It's all free for citizens. But if you're a teacher in Cuba, you make $25 a month. If you're a medical doctor, you make $40 a month. Now, just imagine that you've gone through medical school, you're a highly skilled physician, and you're making less than $500 a year. It's really a very, very odd system that is going to be extremely strange for Americans to kind of get their head around.
Well, I did notice this morning on Twitter a couple of the comments you just raised there. And in fact, our listeners should follow Todd at Todd J. Moss on Twitter. You did write, Cuban version of no one ever washes a rental car, no one maintains a government-owned house. And you also wrote, honest question regarding Cuba. How do they sustain a healthcare system paying doctors less than $500 a year? Did you have the chance to talk to either any doctors or anybody else about that when you were there? You know, honestly probing that, how sustainable that kind of a system is.
You know, I didn't talk to any medical doctors, but I did talk to several high-skilled professionals, including professors at the university who are making the equivalent of about $25 a month. And, you know, that was more, you know, that's less than the meal that we had together. And so, you know, I think people are still very cautious. They still, it's a very ideological place. They still want to believe that communism can work. At least some still believe that, and that the system can hold together. But as Cuba opens to the world and people travel more, and they start to engage with the world and they have more options, you know, and it's not just the United States, but Cuban doctors can move to Mexico or Brazil or Europe. And as the demand for medical professionals increases, there's going to be a very, very strong pull for people to continue to leave Cuba if that system does not change. There will always be a hardcore group of ideological holdouts, but I think that most people will probably gravitate away from a place that doesn't pay them very much to a place that pays more. That's certainly what we've seen in almost every other part of the world, and I don't think that Cubans are fundamentally different than everybody else.
Let our listeners know you're going to be on the program this morning, and I just have a few questions from some listeners, which I'll scroll through now. One of them just asking, when you were in Cuba, did you feel safe?
Actually, I felt extremely safe. You know, I had worked at the State Department a couple of years ago, so of course I checked in with with a friend at the U.S. Embassy, and he confirmed absolutely fine to walk around, even in the neighborhoods that don't look so good. You know, because very few people have air conditioning and it's a tropical climate, people come outside and meet with their neighbors as a social activity. So when the sun went down, it was the day was over, there's not much on TV. People are out in the streets talking with their neighbors, playing soccer, playing baseball. I saw martial arts in the parks. And so it's a very, very social atmosphere, and people are extremely, extremely friendly in that manner.
Another listener wants to know if the country was clean.
It was a mix. You know, I think the hotels and restaurants that I saw were pretty clean. The streets, at least parts of them, were relatively clean. There's definitely, you know, there were definitely parts where there was some open trash. You know, I've been to 22 African countries, and I've seen some really tough places, and Cuba didn't strike me as particularly tough in that sense. You know, it's not something that I would worry about as a traveler.
One of our listeners named Pablo says, please tell me that no one in Cuba was asking about Donald Trump.
You know, nobody did. I don't know if they were being polite or, you know, if it wasn't on their mind. But, you know, it's one of the few places I've been where people don't seem to be talking about Donald Trump.
And then one more question from a listener just wants to know, what is the general disposition toward Americans? You've kind of touched on this, but why don't you elaborate on, in general, what the attitude toward Americans was?
Well, I'd say it's hard, you know, just like here where there's a diversity of views about what we should do in Cuba. You know, Cubans also have wide variety of views toward the United States. I'd say in general, people were quite open and friendly toward American civilians, but still quite skeptical, and in some cases still maybe hostile to our government. You know, I think that it's been ingrained in Cubans from the time that they first enter school and they join the Communist Youth League, which are still very active, that the problems of Cuba are the result of Big Brother, the United States, because of the embargo, because of the Central Intelligence Agency. So there's a very, very long history of skepticism toward the United States. And I think that that's going to take some time for our government to change that perception. But I think at the people-to-people level, there's nothing that that a traveler would really need to worry about.
Got a few more minutes with Todd Moss, who is not only a Rochester native, he's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, the Chief Operating Officer of the Center for Global Development, and he's also a thriller writer. And you've heard him on this program talking about his first two books, Golden Hour and Minute Zero, and the forthcoming Judd Riker novel is Ghosts of Havana. And Todd, first of all, on the novel side of things, why did you then turn your attention to Havana, to Cuba, when we've seen so much great work coming from you from Africa?
You know, I was thinking about countries. You know, my career, I've worked mostly on Africa, but I was thinking about countries that are ripe for major transition. And this was almost 2 years ago when I started outlining this book. And Cuba was just a very, very obvious candidate. President Obama threw me a little bit of a curveball by announcing his surprise normalization plans in December 2014.
Well, this is probably good for you.
Through the first draft.
It's probably good for you, isn't it? No? Oh, well, it probably does make some rewriting necessary, I guess.
it did, but, you know, I think that this is going to be a long process. The president is in a rush because he's only got 10 months left, but, the you know, Cuba and the United States are going to have many, many years to try to figure out how we're going to work together more closely. And there are going to be lots of forces both in the United States and inside Cuba that are going to try to stop it. And I thought that that was a great premise for a thriller novel, which opens with four suburban dads fishing off the coast of Florida when they're captured by the Cuban Navy. And Judd Riker is sent to Havana for secret talks to try to get them released. And of course, nobody is who they appear to be, and Judd Riker has to figure that all out before he can save the day.
All right, so who are these fishermen? Give it all away. Come on.
You know, it's thriller. All fiction writers draw on people they know. So some of the fishermen are based on some of my neighbors here in suburban Washington D.C., including a very good friend who's a Cuban American. Who would love to go back to Cuba one day, and I thought that would be a great premise for an international thriller.
All right, and Todd, forgive me if I missed it, but through the course of your research and planning here, when was the first time you went to Cuba?
So actually, the first time was a couple of weeks ago. A dirty secret of fiction writers is that people set their books in places that they haven't been. That actually happens quite often. The way I did this, the way I was able to write about Cuba is that actually most of the political intrigue takes place in Washington, D.C. and in South Florida, two places I've spent a lot of time. And there's not a ton of action that actually happens in Cuba. Some of it in Guantanamo Bay, some of it offshore, a little bit in Havana. But, you know, one of the great things about the internet today is that it's easy to do a lot of research and even to get the flavor of foreign places, even if you haven't spent a lot of time there.
Sure. Well, before we let you go here, let me just ask then, I think early on in our discussions, when Golden Hour was coming out and you talked about your work as a fiction writer, and I think your desire to, obviously, to entertain, of course, but also to maybe occasionally shine a light on parts of the world that Americans only have a cursory understanding of. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think places like, you know, I've written three books, one on West Africa, one on Southern Africa, and now one on Cuba, are three regions that are going to be more and more in the news, More and more Americans are going to travel to these places, and they're going to be in the newspapers, and they're going to be places where the U.S. government has to make decisions about what are we going to do. So I did want to take readers inside the State Department, inside the White House, inside our embassies to hear how people debate these issues, and for regions that might not be as familiar as, say, London or Russia to your average American.
And Todd, after our short break here, when we end this conversation, that we're going to finish the hour with a conversation. I have the chance to talk to the ambassador from Mali to the United States, Chiena Koulibaly, who is visiting Rochester because Rochester and Bamako are sister cities, and they are trying to increase, I think, some of the opportunities, particularly for students from Mali or even university professors. They're visiting RIT, CMCC, University of Rochester. And so I've got a chance to talk to Mr. Koulibaly about that. But also, we're going to be talking about the state of affairs in Mali, which is something that, of course, I think the average American doesn't study very much, and maybe understandably so. But you just mentioned the fact that there was another attack in Mali, I think just a few days ago. So how closely are you following events there?
Well, I try my best to follow from Washington. You know, I think Mali is not a place on many Americans' minds, but it is one of our most important allies in that part of the world, which is becoming dangerous, more dangerous almost every day. There's Boko Haram in Nigeria and spilling over the border. There are Al-Qaeda groups throughout the Sahara Desert that are trying to attack us and the French and other allies. And I think even bigger than our counterterrorism objectives in that part of the world, Mali has been a long friend of the United States. It's a young, budding, fragile democracy. It's a place of great culture and potential, and it's really a place that I think the United States will build a closer relationship over the long run. So I'm thrilled that you're speaking with the ambassador, and hopefully more Rochesterians will learn a little bit about Mali and maybe go there one day.
Sure, and I'll close with this. I read with great interest Jeffrey Goldberg's piece in The Atlantic on the Obama Doctrine, 20,000 words on the president's foreign policy, and as anyone would expect, a discussion on what led to Libya, our intervention in Libya, Hillary Clinton's role. The New York Times has reported more closely on that recently. And I'll have the chance to ask the ambassador from Mali just how detrimental the destabilization of Libya has been to that entire region. What do you expect that answer to be? I mean, from your perspective, the situation in Libya, how much of a domino effect could that have on that entire region?
Oh, it's already been absolutely devastating. So when Libya imploded, Gaddafi had all of these well-armed, well-trained mercenaries from around the world, and they all just took their weapons and fled. And now you have marauding gangs of people who are very, very capable, and they have nowhere to go. And it was precisely those groups from Libya coming into Mali in 2012. 2013, that led to the almost fall of the Malian government that was really only saved by the French military. And that would have had an even more devastating effect on the whole region, would have made our allies less safe, and it certainly would have affected the national security of the United States.
Well, Todd, I enjoyed seeing your byline in USA Today. Are we going to see more of your work in different places? Where's a good place to kind of follow along with your work before your next book comes out?
You know, Twitter, I'm fairly active on Twitter. Try not to let it distract me from my day job or
yes,
my writing.
Yes.
It's a little hard. But I'll continue to try to put things into the mainstream press about sub-Saharan Africa, about the U.S. place in the world, and increasingly on Cuba, which is, a country that I think is just going to become, eventually is going to be part of the Western Hemisphere in a more normal way. We're not there yet, but I'm hopeful that the events of this week will help push that forward.
USA Today, Cuba's charming tragic time warp is Todd Moss's column this week. He had a chance to travel there before President Obama's visit and taking the time for this program from Washington. Todd, great to talk to you. I know you're back in Rochester on occasion. I look forward to more discussions on foreign policy, but also on the work that you've been doing, writing novels and tremendously successfully writing novels. Continued success to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Great. Looking forward to it, Evan.